If you like to take pictures, maybe just put your phone into airplane mode with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth off. So it's my first time doing this talk. I'm kind of excited about this. So we have people recovering from autism, but it's obviously still challenging. No one says it's easy. So we want to talk about ways to simplify the process. We definitely need to acknowledge that we don't want to make it simple, because if it was simple, we'd be done with this. But we do need to acknowledge the complexity of it, but look for ways to simplify that complexity and with different concepts and categories. So we'll be talking about different categories of treatments and approaches, and different steps and sequences. I had success. I had two boys that recovered and did really well, like fully recovered. But you know, meeting with my doctor, a couple months ago for lunch, we were both talking about how our thoughts had evolved on this, and we said, yeah, we had success, and he had success, of course, with hundreds of kids, but we both kind of came to the same conclusion. We would have done it completely differently. If anything, we almost did everything backwards, and we just said, wow, there's some room for improvement. We want to share, what we've learned. So this is really all the information I wish I had had in the very beginning when this all started. So if I could go back to myself in time and kind of whisper in my ear and say, oh, my gosh, do this, 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 and this, and this, this is what you'd kind of wished for. And I'm hoping that some of this lands for you. So, again, there's no need to take notes. All of this stuff will be online. Matter of fact, we've actually even done a little booklet. And I think this is like a little 24-page booklet. And you can sit down with this. And some of the key diagrams are in the booklet and so forth. So if you want to quietly read this on the plane or in a cozy corner to remember how this all works and use as a reference. I like to have printed references. So my background, again, I had two boys on the spectrum, and they recovered. But I think some of my best learning came from not just from my doctors, but from me having environmental illnesses from the same factors that were impacting my children. So I had mercury poisoning. I had all kinds of food allergies, I had yeast overgrowth, kind of all the stuff that's kind of on the spectrum kind of things. But again, my brain had already gone through and developed, so I was getting challenged, but it wasn't impeding my development. But the big surprise for me working in Silicon Valley was that I became electrosensitive and sensitive to EMF, and I didn't know how to deal. My brain was saying, hey, this stuff is great, and I love this stuff, and my body was giving me a very different message. So it was kind of not a fun experience, but it was a blessing in disguise, that the ability to kind of experience things and not just intellectually go through that. I really think, in retrospect, that you think and assume your way into these autism things, and I think you really feel and sense your way out of it. And it was nice to have that experience. So my background is, I come from a medical family, but I'm not a doctor. I was an engineer and software designer. So I started out as a troubleshooter, troubleshooting workstations and supercomputers. And even doing like advanced escalations when all the other folks had failed, I was the guy that, I was the last stop before engineers would work on it. So then I became an engineer and a software developer and a software designer. So I was a principal software designer for some companies you would know, like Netflix. If you know Netflix, I was their principal software designer in 2004 and 5. So a lot of people have used things that I've designed and worked on. And so I'm used to working at scale, and I'm used to trying to make things that are really, really complicated really simple for people. Not because we're dumb, but because we're really busy and we have other things to do. All right. So that was my job, and I loved it. And I've also been blessed to be able to do funding for autism and environmental health, which gave me access to doctors and some of the key leaders in this field. And so I could just sit down and ask one-on-one questions from some of the best people in the world. And so I got insights that were really interesting. And you could just have one-on-one questions, and I could say, oh, I think this. And they would say, well, or they would say, yeah, exactly. And so I like to do, just like I do work with engineers, I like to translate some of those complex things from biology and try to translate those into simple paradigms that people can work with. So again, I've had access to these folks. So I'll give you our family story in a little bit more detail. So my oldest son, Jack, was kicked out of preschool, I think around age 4. And, then we've all had that situation. And had no idea what was going on and, treated it genetic, thought it was just genetic, right, and did all the coping stuff for about 4 years until I learned about the biological stuff. And I was having a little bit of health issue at the time. And so we started doing enzymes and some of the biological stuff. And, you know, it blows your mind when you find all this stuff and you've never been told it before. I mean, so, again, so, and then we had toxic metals going on. We had yeast overgrowth. My second son regressed into autism pretty rapidly and kind of became very antisocial, similar situation with the preschool. So we quickly worked with my doctor, found a doctor and a Dan doctor at the time, and our doctor kind of helped slowly detox, and the kids got much better, and kind of slowly the symptoms melted away. But for me, again, after doing the detox, I got worse and lost a lot of weight and had some sleep disruption and became really, really sensitive, something you would now call environmental illness, so a lot of multiple chemical sensitivity to the mold and smells and all that stuff. And again, these are kind of related, I would say. So my goal, of course, I just want my kids to reach their own potential. And I realized, too, that my wife had a very different approach. My wife would just follow directions from whatever people told her. And I came from a medical family, which was good in one sense, but also I was skeptical enough. My mom, as a nurse especially, was like, oh, my God, don't let them do that, you know. So I had a little bit of the behind-the-curtain scene, and I would be skeptical. My wife wouldn't. And I realized I need to protect my own health, because if I don't advocate for my kids, my wife is just kind of going to go along with things. You know, we fight about it. Does anyone fight with their spouse on any of this stuff? It's like, yeah. So kind of a big thing we don't talk about. We used to fight about food a lot, which was in one sense good, because it forced me into the environmental stuff that I wouldn't have normally gone into. So today where we are, my wife and I fight a little less. No, my wife was not so symptomatic, but she had heavy metals issues as well. So my son Jack just graduated from UC Berkeley studying computer science and statistics, and he's looking at grad school in computer science as well. He's going to go back probably to Cal, but he's got some other choices too we're going to see. My son Max, who was kind of antisocial, literally did not have a friend until he was six. And I think it's just because the kid was nice and not necessarily because Max was really, you know, super social at the time. Max is, he won an award last year in high school for best actor, and is in a fraternity, and he's got all these buddies, and they, you know, and it's a really lovely situation, and I'm really proud of him. He's studying data science at UC Berkeley as well. So I'm back to a healthy weight. So I was down to 131 pounds. I was pretty skeletal. It's about 25 pounds less than I am now. And I was cracking teeth and kind of demineralizing. And my eyes, I just didn't look solid or feel solid. And I was doing everything I knew of to try to be healthy. And it was really, for me, EMF was a big part of that. But there's a lot of things going on. So, again, I want every family living with autism to have all the advantages I have. So I had a little bit more time, a little bit more money, access to experts, and it was still hard for me. So I want to share those with everyone as much as possible and see how easy we can make this for people. But first, we really have to acknowledge that autism is super complex. So there's, you know, scientists thought, oh, we're going to find a gene. I was talking to the president of Cure Autism Now back in maybe 2004. I said, what's the strategy? He goes, oh, we're going to find a gene, we're going to get a drug. And I'm like, well, what about getting rid of environmental factors? What about, you know, so what happened is we've got like 1,000 genes now, okay, associated with autism. And also we have uninherited mutations. We have genes that didn't get passed down correctly to our kids. So de novo mutations came out in about 2007. And honestly, I'm a little concerned about that. Everyone's like, well, it's aging parents and so forth. But I want to see, is that de novo mutation rate rising in autism? What are the factors that are causing that? Is not just aging. Everyone's saying aging dads. But clearly there's going to be some physiological factors, some environmental factors. And again, you know, glyphosate, cell phone in the pocket for the dad. So there's some concerning factors there. And again, a wide array of behavioral and biological symptoms and a lot of differences in this field. So again, and people were saying, well, we're going to find this environmental factor, and okay, it's going to be the thimerosal, or it's going to be the glyphosate. We go after these, you know, single things, and it turns out we've got risk factors all over the board. I was one of the folks, I really went hot after mercury and spent maybe 10 or 12 years focusing specifically on that, doing U.S. policy. We sued EPA with some folks and won, worked on the international mercury policy. So I've done some great work there along and supported some folks doing some great work. But I have to kind of come out of my silo and just acknowledge that it's not just mercury. And so here's a talk I did last year to try to, so if you've been just focusing on one area like I did, and a lot of people focus on vaccines or on certain areas, I want you to look at, there's a lot going on here. So these are all links or highly suspect areas. So we've got a lot of medical risks going on. This is a little bit of an eye chart. This is in the booklet, so you can read that, and it's in the slides from last year too. But we're not going to dwell on this too much, but we've got medical risks going on. We've got all these chemical risks going on. We've got more than 80,000 chemicals in commerce. We have electromagnetic fields and wireless radiation that I spoke about yesterday, and a lot of lifestyle risks, just sun and sunscreen and screen time and television use, which is really tricky. So I realized going back that there was, you know, spending all this time doing this, that there were definitely some dead ends in my thinking and clearly thinking autism is a lifelong condition is a bit of a dead end. It's just not even factually correct. So we have kids recovering, and we have kids, about 20% or so kids regressing, who are normally developing, regressing into autism. So we clearly need to have a better biomarker for what autism is so we can measure where people are on the spectrum. But it is a little bit that this mindset, thinking that it's a lifelong condition, of course, prevents you from taking any action to really try to mitigate this. And again, addressing things only at the behavioral level or only the sensory level. So I did a lot of sensory integration work and calming and so forth, a lot of swinging. And, of course, a lot of people jump in and do ABA therapy. And, you know, again, these things work. But I remember one day swinging my child, and I'm like, I'm swinging for like 30 minutes a day or an hour. I was like, this is like mowing the lawn. This is never going to end. I mean, this is exhausting. And I wonder, am I going to be doing swinging him when he's 30 or something in a giant purple swing? So again, it works. It's a coping mechanism, but it's not really getting at the root cause of things. And again, the thought that de novo mutations are random or from aging dads, it kind of blinds you to the mentality that there we could be having physiological issues or environmental health issues that may be raising that de novo mutation rate. And again, just this mentality that something bad happened in the past, like a bad gene inherited or a vaccine injury, and then it kind of gets you out of the mode that you can correct or fix anything. This concept, I don't even like it when people talk about permanent brain damage from lead, because, that means, what am I not going to remove the lead or not avoid, you know? So there's certain things, so that kind of gets us out of corrective action. And again, so we're really, one of the big issues is really you're not addressing the current environment. So we showed this slide yesterday, and the combination, this is from a study at Stanford on twins and autism, and really kind of sorting out that genetics is only about 38% of autism on average. So we have some people that have one really strong mutation and really don't need any genetic or environmental impacts to be on the spectrum. We have some children who have no known genetic mutations or risk factors for autism, and they're on the spectrum. And then we have some really strange cases. We have identical twins where one is on the spectrum and one is not. And so that really, if you think it's just genetic, you know, here's a case right in front of you. And what was amazing is one of the folks in the talk yesterday said, well, I'm in that situation. I have identical twins, and one child's on the spectrum and the other one is developing typically. And she was like, tell me about this person at Stanford. I want to meet, you know. So that was interesting. But it really, you have to have a model that kind of works with all this stuff. And if it's 38% is genetic, and we really can't control that so much at this point, but we can, sometimes we can't say control the environment entirely, but we can influence the environment pretty substantially in some cases. So Dr. Martha Herbert, has said that if autism is not this lifelong trait, it's more like a state. And I think of it, you can think of it like a state being in debt or in bankruptcy. You know, what if you're in bankruptcy and someone said you can never get out of bankruptcy? You'd never try, right? And then somebody comes along and says, oh, yeah, you can get out of bankruptcy. You just go here and you get out. Or like getting out of jail. Oh, you just walk out the door, you know. So if you don't think it's possible, you don't even try. So this model tries to incorporate how states operate, these states of overload. So on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side, we have kind of the body, and we have all these positive factors that are nutritional and supportive of life. And then we have all these negative factors that kind of draw down our resilience. And on the right-hand side, we have the same thing going on for the environment. We have all these positive things, and then we have all these negative loads and factors that can make the environment less healthy. And if you think about all the therapies you're doing, a lot of them will fall into these categories. You're really either adding something positive to the body or the environment, something nutritious, or something like sunlight or something that getting out in nature, or you're subtracting something negative or trying to rebalance something that's negative or low. And then the one thing that's kind of in the middle of that is that your body has these, you know, your nervous system has these adaptive states that can be, you can go into fight or flight mode. You can be adaptive. You could be, let's say, oversensitive to something that's kind of not really a big deal, or you could be undersensitive to something that, like an infection in your body, right? So your body could be non-adaptive as well, your immune system. So really, so most of the time we'll jump in and we'll try to work on the child directly. But I think in retrospect, what I would do differently is I would start lightening loads in the environment first. So cut the tie to the right. So start focusing on the environment. When you start lightening that load, you're impacting not just your child, but you're impacting your entire family. Because actually we, like, just like my experience is that we're impacted by the same stuff as our kids, and it's stressful for us. And if we don't, this is kind of a put your oxygen mask on, not necessarily first, but at least at the same time as your child. Okay. And then I think what we would try to do next is, like, if your body's stuck in fight or flight mode, almost like it's post-traumatic stress, environmental post-traumatic stress, then you need to kind of get out of that mode, right? And that was one of my mistakes, detoxing. I was in fight or flight mode. I had some post-traumatic stress from military work in the Navy. And my detox was impaired just from that. It's not that my liver was bad. It's not that I had a bad gene. It's just like my body was in the wrong gear for that. And then finally, like, kind of working on balancing the body. And then what happens is at some point, these loads lighten up. You may find one thing that just makes it, you may find one thing that just imbalances the equation again, so you're thriving and going up. You may cut through all of these and nothing happens. You may have a really strong genetic load, but I think it's worth going through this. So I think there is a reason to hope in autism. And not because we have Timothy syndrome, but Timothy syndrome is a simplified form of autism. It's like a single gene mutation in the calcium channel that gives us these autism-like symptoms. And it's in the calcium channel. Okay, so there's a little bit of focus. So you're probably saying, where's the simplicity? You're talking about thousands of genes. You're talking about thousands of environmental factors. When's the simple part coming? Okay, so this is what we're focusing down on. And we're going to find something simple in the body, and this is what we're focusing on. So when some scientists looked at all the known autism genes back in 2014, which at the time was like 667, they found the most common cluster of genes was around the calcium channel. So again, you're seeing calcium. So what's going on in the body here with this? There's also an excellent paper from 2007 linking intercellular calcium dysregulation, intercellular calcium, with all the major biological symptoms of autism. So we're used to thinking about this at a systems level and thinking about it at, like, you know, gut and blood-brain barrier and all these kind of issues at these higher inflammation. But intercellular calcium is linked to all of these, including hormone regulation and infection. So there's some really interesting things that are all kind of coming together in one place. Martin Paul last 3 years has come and spoke. He's a biophysicist. And he spoke about the EMFs and the chemicals as the two main drivers of the autism epidemic. And he starts getting into the mechanism of action of how those two things, which I had exposure to chemicals and EMF, how these two things and others actually, we'll loop in some more too, can create this total load. So what is it? If autism is a state of overload, what exactly is getting overloaded in the body? Okay, so this is a simplified drawing of a cell, basically, of a cell membrane. If it's a neuron, it looks more like the branches of a tree, but I'm just going to draw a circle now. So we have two different channels, and we'll talk about intercellular calcium. In normal operation, you don't want a lot of calcium inside the cell. It's meant to be pretty void of calcium. So it's kind of like a, think of it as a dark room. If you think of calcium as a spark, it's kind of a dark room. And the calcium signal, when it comes in, you can think of it like a little spark that comes in. It's like a flash from across the valley in the darkness of like, hey, get excited, get something's going on here. We need to pay attention, get excited. So the calcium channels, there was a Nobel Prize awarded in the early 2000s, the calcium channels that allow the calcium to come in and out of the cell that create the signaling, they're gated by voltage. They open and close based on voltage, so electricity. So a little spark, a little signal from another cell says, oh my gosh, get excited, pass it along. And this would open up and the calcium would go in and the cell would go on and it would kind of continue the chain. But genetic variations in this can modify how this behaves. Sometimes the little channel can open too long or open at a lower voltage. So again, when we're talking about calcium channel signaling mutations, this is the risk factor. This is the major risk factor in autism genetically. And if you hear people talking about different theories and they don't talk about calcium channel at all and how it links into the genetics, they need to go a little bit deeper. Now, these calcium channels are also tuned by metal ions on the outside of that calcium channel. The outside of the calcium channel has a voltage sensor that amplifies voltage 7.2 million times. So really small signals open the channel. But what's also on the outside of that channel is a MIDAS, a metal ion dependent adhesion site. And so it responds and it changes, it tunes how this behaves in response to the minerals, the healthy minerals that are outside the cell, and it can be disrupted by toxic metals. And I need to learn more about that, but basically it changes the voltage. It can either block the receptor or change the voltage at which this operates at. So you can see how this could make, if you're really low, I think the way it's designed to work is if you're really low in minerals, it makes you more sensitive. And that's adaptive, so you're kind of getting feedback that you need to be more sensitive to your food and what you're eating and all these things or what's going on. Now, there's another way that calcium can get into the cell, and it's through this NDMA receptor. It's a glutamate receptor, and it's involved in reward and addiction. And it can be overactivated by chemical toxins. So again, we can have chemical exposures that can impact the NDMA receptor. Even some of these metals can impact the calcium channel, and they can kind of dysregulate what's going on here, allowing too much calcium to get into the cell. So a little bit of calcium in the cell, you know, is an issue. Well, let's also talk about the cell membrane. So the cell membrane is kind of what the structure that this all sits in, and it kind of stores some of the epigenetics from the family, so the generations of problems going back and how to tune this cell for like survival mode or for abundance mode. And it's designed to protect the cell, and it goes into cell danger mode, which we'll talk about. It also allows there to be a voltage gradient across the cell, so each cell is like a little battery. And the outside of this is a lipid layer. And so some of these lipid therapies by like BioBody, some of the work by Patricia Kane, who's speaking right now, is really interesting and affects this as well. Okay. So one more thing. Again, we just talked about cell danger mode. So if anyone's familiar with Bob Navio's work, the cell performs differently whether it's being threatened or not. So if there's a virus, a toxin, there are a lot of things that can hit the cell membrane and trigger this cell to go in kind of fortress mode, where it goes into lockdown, and the lipids in the protein layer in the middle collapses and the layer gets thinner. So in other words, think of the cell as becoming thin-skinned, okay, and going into this defensive posture, and that changes the voltage gradient across the cell, and it changes how this calcium channel performs. Okay, so what can happen because of all of these variables? Again, some of these being infections. So what I think is really interesting about this is people have talked about toxins and EMF and all these things, but we know that infections in the mom can be a risk factor. Well, how does that tie in? Well, and the epigenetics are a risk factor, so how does that all tie in? Well, this is starting to see it all kind of tie in one place. And so again, cell danger mode, we can have toxins, infections, and even EMF can put the cell into cell danger mode. So what that can do is then you get too much calcium in the cell. So first of all, it's false signaling. It's kind of like a false exciting signal, which is kind of would detune the nervous system. Like if you're a musician playing and someone walked up behind you and kept playing with the tuning knobs on your guitar and you're playing out of tune, you get kind of confused. That's kind of what's going on here. So we also get free radical damage. So Dr. Paul talks about elevated levels of nitric oxide and peroxynitrite and how that can damage the mitochondria, the cell membrane, and DNA. Again, which may be the de novo mutation factor that we're dealing with. And again, so causing inflammation and excitotoxicity. So right now we have a definition of autism that's pretty behavioral. Okay, so we talk about autism is formally diagnosed. We're observing these challenges in communication, social interaction, repetitive behaviors. But, you know, we need a little bit to dig a little bit more deeply to see what's going on because we know this is a biological issue. You can't say something's genetic when you're just looking at some of these things. So I'm going to try to take a stab at this, which is autism is the result of long-term overload of intercellular calcium that impairs, essentially causing excitotoxicity, impairing physiological regulation, brain development, nerve function, sensory function, immune system, and social interaction. Now, if you're an adult and you get this sort of insult, you've got your nervous system has been wired for social interaction. You've been through these experiences and you're challenged by it. So a lot of the adults who are having environmental illness like I did, you're having the same factors hit you, but you've at least had a good period of brain development. Whereas these kids aren't having that chance. So they're so excited that they can't just sit down and learn and settle. So, okay, if that's a better definition of autism, so what would be a better recovery sequence? So in retrospect, as I said, I jumped right in. A lot of people jump right in and do the behavioral work or the sensory work, or they jump right in and do the biological work. I think in retrospect, I would start in the environment. Unless your child has an infection or something like that, I would start in the environment. So I would start lightening the load in the environment. You don't even have to be perfect about it. So clean environment. And then change the mode. This is something I really didn't know about at the time, is that how important your nervous system tuning is. If you become more sympathetically dominant, your body's in fight or flight mode. It's like someone's chasing you around with a knife. You're not going to be cleaning up the kitchen. You're not growing. You're just trying to live for the day. And your body's going to release energy freely, like it's going out of style. Like, you know, it's like wartime spending. You're not worried about the long term. So again, once the body is in a safe or safer environment and the body feels calm and feels safe, then I think getting into the balancing the biology, working with your doctors and doing all the medical stuff that we talk about here is a nice sequence. And again, the final step would then be kind of getting into just growing and doing all these movement therapies and ABA and all of these things that right now, I think in this phase, we are doing things that are raising the signal to noise ratio. So you're creating, you know, if you're doing ABA, it's like very clear. Or you're doing these movement therapies. You're saying, here's how this moves. This is what's going on. And you're repeating it over and over and over. But what I'm saying is if we do these other steps first, you're lowering the noise ratio. So, imagine we're in a room like this and it gets really loud. So I can just raise my voice to speak up. Right, but that takes a little bit more energy, but we can just keep doing that. But the other approach is to ask everyone to be a little bit quieter and then have these one-on-one conversations. So what I'm saying is if we calm down the noise in the environment and then this fight or flight mode, which is noisy inflammatory state, and get the body balanced, the signal to noise ratio goes down. Inflammation is noise at an electrical level. So when you have a hangover or a concussion, you feel slow. That's literally correct. Your brain is operating more slowly. So if we kind of get these underpinning things under control, then these other things that we do with these sensory things, these movement therapies, I think could be more successful. So lighten the load. So it means we need to have some sort of suspect list. Like we don't want to just try to fix everything at once. So debatable, the suspect list is debatable. I think it should be bigger than the actual list. So you know, if you're looking for a serial killer, you probably don't want to have a list of one. You probably want to have a suspect list that's larger than the actual, that nets the actual person in there. And so again, let's say you're looking for a serial killer. If you put one person in jail and the murders still keep happening, you know, keep going, right? And that's what's going on here. So keep going if you're not getting results. So this is an approximate list that I would do. It's certainly debatable, but I definitely underestimated the wireless factors or the invisible factors, things like wireless and air quality and things. So wireless, mercury definitely, aluminum has really come up last year since the whole brain study. I think that's fantastic. glyphosate clearly. I think the two things raising, going up the most, probably wireless and glyphosate. But I don't even know if we have numbers on aluminum too. So EMF, I'm separating that out and calling like the magnetic fields, electric fields, dirty electricity, certainly an issue. More screen time, interactive screen time, and the light and the EMF that goes with that and the stimulation. Total toxic load, like Scott Faber is finding, it's just not one chemical, but just all of toxins that really are a factor. And a lot of toxins can act as electron stealers. So they can act as a class of things that just steal electrons from the body, and that, again, puts the body into fight or flight mode and such. Okay, so another one, of course, Tylenol. People heard about the Tylenol situation, depleting glutathione, and that goes in right before vaccines. That came out of Harvard. So that's another interesting one. So acetaminophen, I would definitely get that out of any kids. I would not use that. There's other ways of doing pain relief that I think are a little safer. Of course, antibiotic use, wiping out the gut flora and other floras. And, of course, glyphosate is registered as an antibiotic. I don't know if people know that. So when you're eating GMO foods, you're kind of eating antibiotics. Or if you're eating meats that have been treated with antibiotics. Another one coming up that is stimulatory and kind of excitatory is, of course, a lot of artificial light and blue light at night. So we're getting more blue light at night than we used to get. And that is just screwing up our circadian rhythms. I think circadian rhythms came up in the last year or two with autism as a big factor. And that kind of all flows together with this. So these are the areas that I would work with. Certainly debatable. If you have things like mold you want to add in, you just, add what you think is harmful in there. And you don't have to be perfect. You can be an 80%er and just try to cover some of your bases and see what's going on. Now, last year I did a talk, Autism in Your Home, and I categorized things in a different way. So I said some of the things that I thought were really impactful were air quality. And air quality, we do breathe a lot of air all day. And our sense of smell goes right into our limbic brain. So if the house doesn't smell safe, if you're smelling chemicals or mold or mildew or something, it goes right into your kind of like limbic brain and can put that body into like unsafe mode pretty rapidly. On the other hand, if it does feel safe and it smells good or whatever, it can be extremely soothing. And you see these kids smelling their own bodies. Do you ever your kids do that where they kind of smell their own skin and stuff? No, nobody does that. All right, never mind. No. Now, I see that. I've seen my kids do that a lot. Water quality, light quality, including ultraviolet, infrared, electromagnetic fields and noise, the screen time. Food, obviously, people normally jump on that pretty quickly, but I think there's some other things you can do. Some of the food stuff, and some of these things get addictive. I think screen time and food get pretty addictive. And so when you start trying to change those behaviors when the kids are overloaded, it's pretty rigid. So what I like to do is work outside in and start changing the environment around the child. And then once the child's a little calmer and sleeping well and the whole family is a little bit calmer, then these other more things like food screen and food time changes might not be so dramatic. And again, personal care, household products, and herbicides and pesticides. So those were the categories I had from last year and on that talk as we go deeper. So, how do we change the mode? So when the body gets into this fight or flight mode or the sympathetic nervous system dominance, it's really not a sustainable state. It was designed to run away from a threat for 4 or 5 minutes and then stop and then go back into kind of a chill mode. But a lot of our modern stressors are constant and we're non-adaptably, taking a fight or flight response to a flickering light or a Wi-Fi signal. And, guess what? It's the Wi-Fi signal's not going away. The flickering light might, but... So again, this fight or flight mode limits your thinking and circulation. So your brain, you don't even have access to your frontal lobe as much. Your blood is back here. And so you're really doing more kind of reactive things. And if you meet people who are what Annie Hopper would call limbic, people are really, really triggered in fight or flight mode. They're very negative. They're very reactive. You know adults that are like this. And especially if you're an autistic parent, you might be in this mode because it's so stressful. It's not someone saying it's like instead of post-traumatic stress, it's no continuous. You're like, I wish it was post-traumatic stress. It's still going on. From the kids' day-to-day stuff, and again, from these environmental factors. So again, what I always wondered in these states, with some of these kids who have mitochondrial damage, how come they seem to have so much energy? And because they should be laying on a couch just doing whatever, right, just trying to conserve energy. But Victoria Dunkley clarified this a couple years ago. She does a lot of screen time and work. And she said, well, if the body gets into sympathetic nervous system, into fight or flight mode, there's this release of energy so that you can fight or flight. And so now these kids think that there's a threat, and so they've got all this energy, and they're working it off, right? And you know how that feels, like when you're feeling stressed or whatever, and you start, you know, performing or running or whatever, the stress dissipates. You don't feel that all that extra energy. And so I think they're doing something adaptive. They're trying to release that extra pent-up energy. A more adaptive thing would be to release the stress, lower the stressors, and calm the child. And again, detox, repair, and are deprioritized or turned off, right? So you may have a perfectly functioning detox system, but your body's just, it's like having a car that's just not in the right gear to drive. I would actually say, too, fight or flight mode, it's like trying to drive across the country in first gear or in reverse even. It's just, you know, you can do it, but it's really stressful. So how do we change the modes? I mean, a lot of times we're doing these things already. So we're doing these sensory therapies to calm people, but we're going out in nature. We're doing a lot of these animal therapies with horses and dogs. Breath work, of course, you see a lot of parents doing work with breath and yoga. And I always get caught in the chest breathing and not the belly breathing, right? So kind of four square breathing, really taking the time to do that. Cranial sacral, I think it's been helpful if people use cranial sacral therapy. I think that's been really helpful. Even chiropractic, we had some forms of NUCA. There's been some chiropractors talking about this. When the head is tilted forward like that, it usually is a sign of sympathetic nervous system dominance, or when the shoulders are tilted. When you see this kind of real misalignment in the skeleton, it's a defensive posture, and a lot of resetting things and aligning things can really help and take a load off the system. Neurofeedback techniques, brain state is one that helps, but there are many others. And again, there are all these environmental triggers that can bias us into that direction, especially these invisible ones. So again, wireless and EMF, really big triggers. Again, I had to learn that one the hard way. Light flicker. A lot of people and kids just really hate fluorescent lights for multiple reasons. Buzzing noise, the color temperature, and then usually it's a flicker. In my talk last year, I talked about a quick way of checking for light flicker. There are expensive meters you can get, but if you take your phone and put it in slow motion video and then go around your house and video the lights and then play it back, you might see some of the lights that are flickering. Air quality, again, totally invisible and can have a really dramatic impact on things, especially the senses of smells and VOCs, artificial scents, really creep people out when you're sensitive. So again, balancing the body. I don't have to say too much about this because I'm not a doctor, and this conference is all about this. So again, work with a MAPS doctor, DAN doctor, you know, functional medicine doctors. And just to highlight, there are some supplements that reduce intercellular calcium from some of these papers. Dr. Paul has talked about magnesium is a natural calcium channel blocker, or we would say low magnesium makes the calcium channel hyperactive. There's a form of magnesium that several doctors have been recommending lately called magnesium threonate, which doesn't upset the gut. And it gets more deeply into the brain and spinal column where we kind of need it, where these calcium channels are most dense in the nervous system and in the heart. Okay. And so magnesium, B12, B6, those sound kind of familiar, eh? It's almost like we've learned something, right? And so I think there are more things going on too with balancing the body. Again, lowering infection levels. There are a lot of different factors we need that are really, I think, indirectly tuning these the calcium inside. Mineral depletion is another one. So if you get really depleted minerals, then you're really detuning. You're making that calcium channel more sensitive, adaptively so. And that's been one of the things that some doctors have been talking about. We've been talking about a lot of negative things to remove from the environment, but some people have said, you know, over the last decades, we've had some real serious soil depletion going on, or mineral depletion. And so the food just has less minerals in it. And our body is really craving those core minerals. So this last phase, kind of, I would say, grow and flow, it's almost like a no-op in some ways. And for some people, you may not have to, some people literally unplugging one factor, like unplugging a wireless thing, or you might find one factor that just gets your kid back into the positive thriving state, and you're good to go, and you don't even have to get into this. But again, now you might be calm and balanced enough to really learn and grow naturally without any extra help. You might be sleeping well, so now you can do, your brain can do pruning and grow synapses and do the sort of trauma recovery that it's supposed to do in REM, good REM sleep. Again, natural growth. So you got less noise and more signal naturally, so you don't have to work so hard. So again, this is all about connecting. You could call this section connect or reconnect. Now you're doing sensory therapies, but if your child is still struggling and not going naturally, certainly, you know, do the sensory stuff, do the communication stuff we know that works, do all the things we already know work. And especially the movement therapy and even, you know, play. To me, play is an accelerated learning state. So that's kind of the whole, you know, that's kind of the main gist of it. And so we have some resources. So the slides are at this URL. I'll post these in a couple days, and we'll post the video here as well. And again, I just want to remind you that the booklet is on the way out. You can grab this booklet that has kind of everything we talked about and even some things I have, and I go into a little bit more depth. And then you have all the scientific references, too, which is nice. Okay, so my previous talks that kind of go deeper on some of these areas are Autism in Your Home from last year at this conference, and that's online as well with all the slides and the video. Wireless, a key piece of the autism puzzle. I gave that talk yesterday, and I've done that. That's my fourth time doing that here. And that's all online. 2 years ago, I did a talk called Ending Autism in Your Home and in the World. And that is a little bit more strategic. It's similar to this talk, but a little bit more, I don't know, if you liked what we're talking about here but you want a little more depth, that's a good talk. Or especially if you do advocacy work in this area, you work strategically, that's an interesting talk, I think. And I'd love feedback on that. And finally, of course, Martin Paul's talk on EMF and chemicals as the two main drivers. And he gets more technical on the intercellular calcium and the nitric oxide and that whole chain. So if you'd like more details there, you want to hear it directly from the scientist and see more of the references there, that's a great talk as well. We have some online resources. We have a wireless safety card. I think that was in your packet. You have the little wireless safety card. We have more of those at the booth if you need them. Clearlight Ventures, my website, has a lot of resources on it as well. And we have a Facebook group we just focus on autism and EMF, but we talk about issues slightly outside EMF as well. And I share a lot of my work there. Let's see, I do have also a guide, Safe Household and Personal Care Products. So if you're trying to clean up the personal care products, we have that listed on our website as well. It's a little hidden, though, and so if you have problems finding that, tell me and give me feedback. The Environmental Working Group has a great website on healthy living and how to clean up your home. And finally, of course, really for tracking progress, one of the key elements is like using the ATEC score. Have people using ATEC to track their... Yeah, that's fantastic, because that'll really give you good feedback about how you're progressing and if you're regressing or what's going on. So that's kind of the talk, and we have time for Q&A. We still have about 15 minutes for Q&A. Any questions? Start there. The question is, should we discontinue calcium supplementation? I talk to your doctor about that. It depends. I mean, I've heard some people talking about there's definitely calcium dysregulation. Well, some people said, oh my gosh, when they heard about calcium dysregulation, they're like, well, should I take more calcium? I don't know. I would work with your doctor on that. I mean, if you've got more calcium, if there's calcium dysregulation, there's too much on the outside, that can also be a factor that gets too much on the inside. I think it's really, for me personally, if you take calcium in the right ratio with magnesium, that works pretty well. So I think calcium, we still want it for bone growth. And I think one of the other key factors is K2 to make sure that the factor that might be more important than the calcium that's personally been good for me is K2, which helps the calcium go where it's supposed to go so that it's not outside the cell. And if you, I've heard good feedback on K2, but again, talk to your doctor on that one. That's a great question though. Right.
All of the kids have either iPads or laptops provided by the district, and then he goes to APA about 20 hours a week, and they use a wireless, an iPad to document progress. But how can I protect him when he's constantly
exactly
limiting screen time at home?
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so the question is, how can I limit exposure? Because when I go to school and ABA, they're using wireless constantly. So I would say the most important thing is you're limiting it at home, especially in the sleep environment. So if you really got the sleep environment down, they might be more resilient to those exposures. And then start feeding information to the schools about this topic. So I'm really excited. I just got an email yesterday. I have a woman in Massachusetts that's been working on, she actually was a, what do you call it, Education Foundation president, and had been raising all this money to bring all the high tech into the schools. Then she heard about this, and she was like, oh my gosh. And so she's now been doing all this work. Her name is Cece Doucette. And Cece's been great, and she's been running a network. She's got all this stuff going on in the state of Massachusetts, and her school has signs up that says when the wireless is not being used, it should be turned off. Now, I'm very excited to say, and I have to look at the details more, but that the San Francisco school district just agreed that there's enough evidence that wireless is harmful. And actually, I think that this fall that they'll be reevaluating cancer. The cancer status right now, it's a class 2B carcinogen, possible carcinogen, but several people who were on the panel that classified it as 2B, at least two of them and I know, have said that it now warrants class 1 status, the same as tobacco. So it'll be really hard to justify if the WHO shifts that, and there's already evidence that's, there's evidence enough. So now the San Francisco School District has said, yes, we believe this is now a credible enough threat that we're going to start transitioning out. I'm working with some pretty large companies now that I also feel that there's some credibility there, and we're working on lowering exposure. I wrote a paper on lowering power of Wi-Fi. They can try to emulate, like use eco-Wi-Fi that can have a slower beaconing frequency that's 90% less radiation exposure and doesn't slow the system down. So there are some things to do, and if their ABA, if their communication device does not require an online connection, well, actually, I would say this. If they can put their thing in airplane mode and turn off Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, that's the best. If their communication device requires some connection to the network, they can get for $20 or $30, they can get a connection that goes into an iPad that plugs into an Ethernet cable, and then they'll have that online connection, and they'll have all that technology, but they won't be getting that wireless radiation exposure. And I would also say with those devices, to dial down the blue light, not just at night, like with night shift and other programs, but even during the day, because these kids, anything that's excitatory, blue light is excitatory, is going to be, it's overload for these guys. Thank you. Len, sorry.
With respect to an iPad, if you don't have the ability to connect to an Ethernet connection, can you just comment on, in terms of exposure, cellular versus Wi-Fi versus Bluetooth?
Right. I got that question yesterday. It's hard to tell between cellular and Bluetooth. It's a little tricky. I would say it's tricky and kind of depends on the situation. You have to measure. Bluetooth, doing the hotspot, like a lot of people will try to do a hotspot, that's probably the worst. I think I would prefer cellular over Wi-Fi, but it depends. And I think, you know, the best, of course, would be connecting. And then you can use distance, get the device farther away from your lap. Like, don't use it right on your lap. There are devices like Hara pads and Defender pads that can put a little shield between you and your lap and your body. And so those can be helpful as well.
Can you talk a little bit about measurement devices?
You know, oh, yeah. So, yes. So at 2 o'clock, we're actually going to be doing, some people have had questions. We've got meters this year for measuring EMF. A lot of people are new to this. So at 2 o'clock, we're going to be doing a demo on different meters near the little tent out here. And also, that's another invite, is if you haven't experienced the difference between being out here and then going into the tent, you can actually experience that one slide where the calcium channel goes down, the calcium's going in. What happens when you block off the EMF false signaling? You start to feel calmer right away. And that's kind of the experience. Some people feel calmer. Some people say they feel more in their bodies. They have different experiences. Have your own experience. Give us feedback. But most people will have some sort of experience. So thanks for reminding me of that, Len. Well, it's hard on your nervous system, right?
Well, it makes me go crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it is. No, exactly. So I know I have some friends with epilepsy. I don't have epilepsy, but I have cousins and friends who have epilepsy. And I know that there are certain frequencies of light flicker that are harder on epileptics. And I think, as I recall, it's 7 hertz is a really bad, and maybe even multiples of that are really hard on epileptics. So, minimize the flicker as much as possible. We do have a light in the tent that is a DC-powered light that's constantly on with a low color temperature, a warm color temperature. And so I'm working with some companies I can't talk about right now, but we're working on maybe some nice DC non-flickering light sources that would be great for work environments and school environments that would be good light quality but not, trigger the nervous system. But, as much daylight as you can is fantastic. You have a dimmer. Yeah, exactly. Some of that can be related to electrical noise in your wiring as well. Sometimes it's so that's either the bulb itself. It's like if it's a compact fluorescent or LED, sometimes there's some really high frequency flutters with those. Sometimes it's the dimmer itself that creates a lot of noise. Sometimes it's the electrical that has noise in it. And sometimes it's just like the 50 or 60 hertz flicker. That you'll even see if you watch baseball. Have you ever watched the slow motion World Series and they're showing a slow motion pitch like this? You'll see the background, the light in the background changing, and you're seeing basically the 50, 60 hertz. The light, even those big lights, are doing a flicker. And it's until I saw the World Series, I was like, wow, that really, even these incandescent lights do that. So it's really interesting to get a slow motion camera out and look at that. Or if you have a building biologist, they have like about a $600 flicker meter, and you can find out you can find the exact levels of flicker. And again, but your body is probably the best meter. Your body will give you feedback. Great question. Thank you. Any other? Let's see. We're down to. We still have about 4 or 5 minutes. Any other questions?
If you have a smart meter on your home, what's the best way to protect
your family? The best way would be to opt out of the smart meter if you have the ability to do that. You don't have the ability to do that. Yeah. So a lot of states don't. So in California, we can opt out. There are multiple approaches. There are. I think one of the best groups on that is a film called Take Back Your Power, and they have that gives you a lot of details on smart meters, and their website has a lot of solutions on what to do with different smart meters. Some of the smart meters are really harsh and bad, and some of the ones, like in Southern California, are not as bad. So I think step one is kind of measure, and not all the meters can measure. We've got a couple meters we have here, especially the Cornet meter, will be good at catching those. So in California, where we are, we get about every 6 seconds, we'll get a pretty harsh pulse. But we've noticed that the companies have dialed that down a little bit, which is good. So your two things with the smart meter, you want to block the wireless pulses that are coming out. Now, you can do that with distance. You can be as far away from that meter as possible. You can put shielding on the opposite side of the wall so it doesn't come in to you. Some people have these cages. Less EMF has these little things that go around and keep the keep it from bouncing all over and going sideways, and it just kind of keeps the signal in a kind of a straight line. And then there's also an issue with dirty electricity or electrical noise from a switching power supply in the meters that creates noise throughout the house. And that's another solution of dirty electricity. So that's covered. We have a booklet out here that talks about smart meters and dirty electricity, and so there's details on that as well. But it's a complex topic. Again? So the question is there any credence to the necklaces that are supposed to protect your kids from EMF? So it's a tricky topic. I mean, definitely there are some things that do help with the kids, right? And if you put the thing on and you feel better, great, go for it. What does tend to happen, though, is that people will put that on and just think it's magic and not try to fix anything around them. But you do really want to fix these exposures and start measuring them, because at some point that is not going to be enough. When we get to 5G, is that going to be enough? I don't know, right? And when you're looking at those, make sure that they at least help prevent blood clumping or have some data maybe around preventing sperm damage and other things. If they've got some sort of double-blind placebo testing, there are some that do. So look for that sort of thing. Thank you. Yes? Okay. So you have a big electrical box right outside your back door. A big transformer box. Yeah. Right. Okay. And they won't move it. Okay. And it's above ground. Yeah. Behind. Yep. Okay. So you have a a big pad transformer behind your apartment complex. And the question is that dangerous or not? So that pad transformer will give off a big magnetic field. Magnetic fields have been listed as a possible carcinogen since 2001. And building biologists would like to see your bedroom less than 20 nanotesla or 0.2 milligauss. So we have meters for measuring that. If you're below that level, so I always say measure. You know, use distance, get away from it as far as possible and measure. And sometimes there's something, you'll see a pad transformer, but then in your room it's fine. And sometimes I worked with one parent who had a really strong magnetic field, and I couldn't figure out what it was. It was high tension lines from a mile away, right? Yeah, no, exactly. Like, exactly. So it might be an issue. It may not. You should measure. And again, so you could have a building biologist come out or get an inexpensive meter to measure that and see. Really, mostly you're concerned about your sleep environment. And so it could be a problem, but it may not be. That's about, I think we've got about 2 minutes left. I want to wrap. We have one more question. It's the same question. So is there any truth to the small dots? So those are shungite dots, right? So it's a form of graphite. And he does have some study there showing, like, I think it was live blood pumping. He's got some study showing a reduction in SAR value. Now, reduction in the heat is not the only thing, but some people have been very electrosensitive respond well to shungite. But again, the combination would be reduce your exposures as much as possible, and then, you know, if you feel comfortable doing that. But again, I'd be concerned with, you don't want to have stuff on your thing and then put your cell phone in your pocket and then expect to have no sperm damage or something. I'd really like to see some of the folks doing work on sperm damage and cell phones a little bit more. All right, we'll wrap it up at that. Thank you very much. And don't forget to grab one of these on the way out if you're interested.